loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou and joined in studio by Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, despite being caught in a lie, CNN is standing behind their reporting. Lanny Davis, a lawyer for former President Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen, told CNN as an anonymous source that Cohen had details on the Trump Tower meeting that special counsel Robert Mueller is keen to find out about. He told several other outlets after that, but in the past few days, he's been saying Cohen doesn't necessarily have that information. Next, Donald Trump tweeted this morning criticizing Google's manipulation of search results. While his outrage was directed at their reported suppression of right-wing outlets, beneath the surface are huge implications about Google's power and ability to surveil virtually every part of our lives. Then, Chemnitz, a German city in the state of Saxony, has erupted in racist rioting and violence in the last few days, with crowds yelling anti-immigrant slogans and using the illegal Nazi straight arm salute, facing off with other crowds of anti-racist protesters. What does this mean for the rise of the far right in Germany and in Europe as a whole? And then, the Russian defense minister today announced that huge military drills involving hundreds of thousands of soldiers will take place in the country's east next month. With a sizable contingent of Chinese troops expected to participate, many are taking this as a sign that the two rising powers are moving closer together in response to the U.S. government's new doctrine of, quote, major power conflict. And finally, Iran's parliament censured President Hassan Rouhani today and referred him to the judiciary. This comes shortly after the ministers of economy and labor were fired by lawmakers. What's going on in Iran's government and what role do U.S. sanctions play? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to CNN's coverage of Michael Cohen and his lawyer, Lanny Davis, and whether or not Michael Cohen actually has something to tell Robert Mueller and the Mueller probe regarding possible collusion between the Donald Trump campaign of 2016 and the Russian government. We're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose latest is, be careful what you ask for, wasting time with Manafort, Cohen, and Russiagate. Jim Kavanaugh, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Lanny Davis went on MSNBC and said Michael Cohen has, this is after Michael Cohen pled guilty to multiple charges, said he has more to say about Donald Trump's possible collusion with the Russian government, and in particular about Donald Trump's foreknowledge of a meeting at Trump Tower between Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner, and a Russian lawyer who Rob Goldstone, a friend, had told them had dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russian government. Lanny Davis said that on MSNBC. CNN also reported from an anonymous source that, in fact, that was true. And when they were asked whether the anonymous source was the same Lanny Davis, Michael Cohen's lawyer, they said no. But then Lanny Davis said, yes, I was. I was the source. So we have a situation now where CNN is standing behind a report where they say the source was not Lanny Davis, Michael Cohen's lawyer, but in fact it was. And now we also know, just to help sort of bring this to an end here, that Michael Cohen is saying, I don't have anything else to offer Robert Mueller regarding information about that Trump Tower meeting. A kind of remarkable display of awful, well, false reporting. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, yeah, and clearly Lanny Davis lied and then lied about lying. It was actually Lanny Davis, I think, not CNN, who denied that he was the source for the CNN report and then later on just now admitted that he was the source. So he was saying not only was I the source, but then I lied about being the source. And what's interesting about the whole thing also is that you see the ways in which all of the media outlets which picked this up were kind of relying on the same person. They all called Lanny Davis and said, can you confirm this? So he was confirming a story that he already given out, which was false, and he knew it was false. And then, you know, tried to cover up the fact that he was the source for it and then ended up having to say he wasn't. It all is just a whole of lying mirrors. And, you know, it's about nothing. I mean, this Trump Tower meeting is not proof of anything, but the fact that somebody like this, as you say, this guy, Rob Goldstone, a music producer, tricked the Trumpsters into having a meeting on the thought that they would get dirt on Hillary Clinton. You know, nothing different than the Clintons were doing. Clinton was doing through the Steele dossier. And the lawyer who showed up wasn't interested in that at all and had nothing to say about it. She was interested in the Magnitsky Act and Browder. She was representing someone who was suing Browder. So this is a nothing burger. You know, it's a bunch of lies about nothing. The implication that the media wants you to get and that Lanny Davis wanted the media to get was that Cohen has some secret information, which is going to be the smoking gun for Mueller about Russia collusion with Trump, which she probably doesn't have. So CNN claims they have other sources, but we'll see. You know, the Trump Tower meeting is itself a nothing burger.
Yeah. And again, that was in June 2016. During that same time period, exactly that same time period, by then, I believe the Clinton campaign, the Democratic National Committee, which was essentially under the control of the Clinton campaign or the Clinton campaign, had employed Christopher Steele, a British spy, a British intelligence agent, who went to Russia and used his extensive contacts in Russia, probably with former Russian intelligence agents, to pay them for stories about Donald Trump, very salacious stories about what Donald Trump did. He compiled it into a dossier. The Clinton campaign then tried to have the media look at that dossier because they felt it would harm Donald Trump. Christopher Steele started working with James Comey and the FBI based on the intelligence he gathered, again, as a foreign intelligence agent working with Russians or Russian former intelligence agents and paying them money for an unvetted, uncorroborated story. So when you think about that, when we actually stop and let that sink in, the idea that Donald Trump Jr. would say, "I love it," in response to Rob Goldstone's promise that the Russian lawyer was bringing dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russian government. You are exactly right, Jim. I mean, if you stop and think about it, if people actually stop and think about it, both sides were looking for dirt from whatever quarter they could find dirt on their opponent, and they were paying money for it in many cases.
And more than that, everybody was just taking money from whoever had the money, okay? So Fusion GPS, for whom Steele was working, the head of that, Glenn Simpson, was actually also meeting with the Russian lawyer who came to the Trump Tower meeting. He was coaching her. So, and Len, this lawyer who's now, you know, been a hero of the Clintonites and the Democrats, one of his big clients was Dmitry Firtash, one of the biggest Ukrainian oligarchs who made billions with the Russian oil companies, with Gazprom. So, you know, it's a big incestuous circle, and everybody's shocked that people are taking money from capitalist oligarchs and billionaires everywhere. And at the end of the day, really, it was about the Trump Tower meeting was about, you know, seeing if you could get dirt on your opponent, which everybody was doing, and everybody shocked about that. But there's no proof here of meddling with Russia to hack computers for the election, colluding with Russia, Donald Trump being a Russian agent since 1987, and this is all, you know, it's made to sound as if there's something there, but there's yet, as of yet, no there there.
And Bruce Orr, the United States Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Department of Justice, was also meeting with Glenn Simpson before the election, this Fusion GPS guy who was employing Christopher Steele, the British agent who was working with Russian agents to get bad information or hostile information, opposition research on Donald Trump. He met with him before the election. He met with him after the election. We know that because now his notes have been turned over to the Congressional Committee. And Bruce Orr's wife worked for Glenn Simpson and Fusion GPS, which had hired Christopher Steele. I mean, when you look at, you are totally right. This is a cesspool. It's money. It's corruption. Everybody's trying to make money. There's also politics. Now we have Michael Cohen, Jim Kavanaugh, and Peter Strzok, who have been fired. Michael Cohen is guilty. Pled guilty to 5 cases. He's raised $150,000 in GoFundMe support after Lanny Davis went on TV on an MSNBC saying he had more dirt on Trump's collusion with Russia. And Peter Strzok, this head lead FBI investigator fired for misconduct, he's raised $500,000 in GoFundMe. 30 seconds left. The country has gone crazy.
Yeah, Cohen had to actually raise his, because he got so much money, he just kept raising. I think he went to 300 and now he's gone to 500 or something because he's getting so much money. And he's being fed it. He's being stopped on the street and being clapped as a hero on Fifth Avenue. I mean, this is just silly. You couldn't make this up. It would be a bad movie. But it's the movie that we're in. We're all in it now.
Okay, America devolving into a bad movie. Anyway, that's the voice of Jim Cavanaugh. We were talking to Jim from New York. He is the editor of the polemicistnet.net. His latest article is Be Careful What You Ask For, Wasting Time with Manafort, Cohen, and Russiagate. Jim, can people read that article at the polemicist.net?
Yes, the polemicist.net or Counterpunch.
Okay, very good. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Donald Trump tweeted this morning criticizing Google's manipulation of search results. While his outrage was directed at their reported suppression of right-wing outlets, beneath the surface are huge implications about Google's power and ability to surveil virtually every part of our lives. We're joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology, who just wrote an article related to this issue. Welcome back, Dr. Epstein.
Always a pleasure.
So tell us about your recent research, your recent findings, your analysis of this phenomenon.
Well, the censorship phenomenon, I've been writing about that for quite a while. I did an investigative piece for U.S. News and World Report called The New Censorship. And, you know, because of Trump's remarks or his tweets on this issue, I would urge people to take a look at that article. Again, it's called The New Censorship. Because there are legitimate issues here. So whether Trump is right or wrong and whether, you know, conservative stories are being deliberately suppressed, I mean, that's, in my opinion, is kind of irrelevant to the larger issues here, which is that Google has the power, so does Facebook, of course, so does Twitter, but Google has the power to suppress all kinds of material. It acknowledges suppressing all kinds of material, and who on earth gave it that kind of power to determine what 2.5 billion plus people around the world see or don't see. So to me, that's the big issue here, no matter whether the details of Trump's, you know, recent claim are true or not. Now, let me just add one other thing. Apparently, now the Trump administration might be going ahead somewhat aggressively looking into the possible regulation of Google. Now, that's interesting.
Yeah, indeed, that is interesting. You know, Dr. Epstein, I want to remind our listeners that when we were talking to you weeks ago, you were the one who made the point, in particular on this show, that the Google business model is so far different, say, than the Apple business model, where you were making the point, you know what? Apple makes a lot of money by selling us high-priced, perhaps overpriced stuff that we use, like, you know, MacBook Air, this, that, or the other thing, our iPhones. Google isn't really making its money from that. You were making the point that Google makes its money not from selling us stuff, but actually kind of owning us in a way and treating us as the commodity.
Yes, Google sells us. Google and Facebook have nothing to sell except us. So it's a completely different business model. Microsoft sells, you know, a few things, but mainly they sell software. Google sells us. I mean, it's a business model. I call it the surveillance business model, which I believe should be illegal, in part because it is inherently deceptive, but also because it's tremendously dangerous because of the information that they're collecting about us and the ways that they're discovering to use that information, not just to determine, you know, what we buy and who we vote for, but ultimately to build, you know, models of us that allow these companies to predict our behavior and ultimately to exercise more and more control over our thinking and behavior. It's extremely dangerous. It's a dangerous and deceptive business model, which should be illegal, period.
There's, of course, the danger of Google spying. Well, not the danger, the reality of Google spying on ordinary everyday people. But you also have raised the issue of Google being able to monitor the communications of, for instance, news organizations, monitor the communications and internal deliberations of institutions and organizations. What's the danger there? How is that sort of a qualitatively different thing that we're talking about?
Well, that's my newest article that was just published on Monday in the Daily Caller. And I think it's quite revelatory because I'm looking at an area of surveillance that really no one has ever looked at before. But the fact is that major news organizations and major universities and lots of major businesses very mindlessly and naively share all of their emails, I mean, outgoing and incoming, and lots of very important documents with Google, naively thinking that Google doesn't cherish such information, couldn't possibly want to look at it or store it or analyze it, which is absurd. The fact is, we're talking about organizations like the New York Times, the Guardian, the Times of London, the Financial Times. We're talking about The Daily Caller, The Hill, Wired magazine. These are not, trivial outfits. And all of these organizations and many more and major universities share all of their email with Google. It's absurd, absolutely absurd. And most of these places are just not aware of it. When I've called it to people's attention at these places, some people have expressed concern. But over and over again, I find reporters saying, it's the business people. I'm just a reporter. I don't control the business decisions. It's terrible. This is a huge area of surveillance no one has ever talked about before. And it's, my opinion, extremely dangerous.
In your article entitled How Major News Organizations, Universities, and Businesses Surrender Their Privacy to Google, you write this. By now, you probably know about the model. Google pretends to be the ultimate free public library when it is actually the ultimate surveillance machine, using dozens of free services to gather personal information about us and then monetizing that information. I had an odd hunch during my exchange with the Time editor that Google might be monitoring our emails. So I expanded the header of one of his emails to see what computer servers it had traveled through to reach me. And there it was. And then it's mail-da0-f48.google.com. His emails were being routed through a Google computer because Time, like many other companies, was using Google's business services to handle its emails. Okay, so people are doing this, businesses are doing this for convenience, not really giving it a second thought. Should they be giving it a second thought? What harm comes to the companies themselves?
Well, of course, we can't know for sure. But what we know is that when this happens, Google employees have the ability to monitor all of these communications. And of course, all of this information is getting collected and stored and analyzed. Now, I talked to two former software engineers at Google about this issue. The fact is, this is extremely high value data. This is more valuable than whether you're searching for umbrellas, to buy for your house. This is extremely high valuable data. Google is the biggest data miner in the history of humankind. High-value data have value. So, Google, in fact, collects this information, analyzes it, stores it. As far as anyone can tell, they store it permanently. And, this is sensitive data. This gives Google the ability to monitor ongoing investigations by investigative journalists. This gives Google the ability to assess companies that they might want to buy, to make interesting kinds of stock decisions, and so on and so forth. I mean, this gives Google access to a world of information that they should have no access to whatsoever. We're also talking about major universities here, too, including UCLA and Columbia University and hundreds of others.
And if there were, say, a major push to regulate Google or even break up Google, by the same logic, by what you're arguing, Google would actually be in a position to monitor the communications, perhaps, of people who were involved in that effort to regulate their own company.
Well, that's my point, is that Google is now monitoring many, many thousands of very sensitive communications every single day. And no one has ever pointed this out before.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's like so important.
Yeah, of course, this is critically important. And by the way, they've been monitoring the communications of investigative reporters such as Carol Cadwalader, whom I mentioned in my article, while she's investigating Google. So even reporters, prominent reporters who are investigating Google, they are being monitored. All the communications with all of their sources, all of the attachments, the documents that are being passed back and forth, all of that is being shared in real time with Google. This makes no sense.
I want to go back because I think this is such an important discussion. The FANG stocks, that's Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google, those four big tech companies, they constitute a huge part of what's going on the stock market. You know, when we used to think about the power of banks, Dr. Epstein, we always thought, well, the banks always knew the exact credit position, the strength and weakness of any company seeking loans, because you had to tell the bank those things in order to acquire a loan. And that gave the bank strategic power in a modern capitalist economy to make the big decisions. But what you're saying right now is even the banks, if they're reliant on these kind of technology platforms like Google, they may not have as much information as is available to Google itself.
Well, they positively don't. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to call attention to another area of surveillance, a vast, vast area. And by the way, it goes beyond what we've just discussed. I know we're short on time, but let me just mention one other issue here, which I explain in the article, which is the scariest part of all. And that is that Google has for years made it very easy for individuals to attach their Gmail email account to their business or university account in a way that makes it look as if they're now using the business account. In other words, they can attach their personal Gmail account to a business account, which causes all of those emails from then on, which appear to be running through the business, to run through Google servers. Now, my guess is, I'm just guessing, but my guess is that millions of people have done this, and this is done without the permission of the institutions, but it immediately makes accessible to Google all of those communications which appear to be running through these institutions. So this problem is a huge problem.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Thank you so much, Dr. Epstein, for coming on the show. We're going to have you back on to continue this really crucial conversation. We've been joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Chemnitz, German city in the state of Saxony, has erupted in racist rioting and violence in the last few days, with crowds yelling anti-immigrant slogans and using the illegal Nazi straight arm salute, and crowds of anti-racist protesters gathering as well to face off with them. We're joined from Edinburgh, Scotland by John White. He's the host of the weekly Sputnik radio show Hard Facts. Welcome back, John.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back.
So tell us what's been going on in the city of Chemnitz. These are really dramatic scenes and images that we've been seeing that have a lot of political significance.
Yeah, well, the catalyst was the stabbing and the murder of a young gentleman who actually was of mixed parentage. His parents were German and Cuban. And the alleged attackers or murderers or killers or assailants were Assyrian and Iraqi, who are now in detention. And this took place in Chemnitz, which is in eastern Germany, East Germany, and ironically was a model socialist city under the old GDR, and has a very, very famous Karl Marx memorial. The far right has gained huge traction in East Germany in particular, within Germany. And so the far right came out onto the streets to protest, and the left, to their credit, anti-Nazi protesters came out to meet them. And the police were completely unprepared. And so what happened with us, what has been happening has been a series of running battles, maybe very similar to what took place in Charlottesville in 2017. And I think this is part of a trend that is taking place all throughout the West in the conditions of economic dislocation, austerity. We've seen the recrudescence, we've talked about this a number of times, of the far right. But now it's increasingly making its presence felt on the streets in a way that it has not, certainly in Europe since the 1930s. And what we do know is that the far right on its own is incapable of rising to prominence because its politics are far too narrow, far too exclusionary. What the far right needs in order to rise to prominence in any given space and time is a connivance of an establishment in crisis. And that dynamic is in place. If I could turn your attention to the UK, we've had Tommy Robinson. Some of your listeners might be aware of who this gentleman is. He was the founder and leader of the self-styled English Defence League, which was an avowed anti-Muslim organisation, organising within the so-called white working class in the UK. And he was put in prison for contempt of court. And this sparked a series of street demonstrations. Free Tommy Robinson. A Free Tommy Robinson movement was set up. And these were the biggest far-right demonstrations in the UK at any time since the 1970s when the National Front was on the march. So it's a very worrying trend that we're seeing take place all throughout Europe and even in the United States, as I say, in the context of Charlottesville. The catalyst there being, of course, the controversy surrounding the Confederate monuments. So that's what's taking place in Germany. There's a lot of anti-migrant hostility. A lot of people are citing the fact that Angela Merkel allowed in so many asylum seekers in 2015, something on the order of 900,000. And they have been demonized and dehumanized, used by the far right. And this goes up to the mainstream, where the AfD, which is the far right anti-migrant party in Germany, the Alternative for Germany, this party was only formed in 2013, yet in 2018, it's already the third largest electoral party in Germany. So that in itself is an index of how far the far right has traveled in such a short space of time.
That's extremely interesting about the dynamism of the ascension of the right. I want to probe that a little bit more. But what we had, John, in this case was there was a conflict between, I believe, two Arab refugees, asylum seekers, and a man of German ethnicity. In the course of this conflict, he was stabbed. He died. But then when you look at the overall trends in Germany, crime is way down. Violent crime is down. There's no indication that the influx of these large number of refugees has done anything to make Germany less safe. It's really just the political parties grabbing hold of it. In the case of the United States, Walter and myself were both involved in organizing the anti-Nazi, anti-KKK protest here in Washington, D.C. on August 12th. We had 15,000 people come out, and the Nazis who had organized and the right wing who had organized Charlottesville the year before, that was August 12th, the year before, we overwhelmed them. I mean, they could only, you know, raise their ugly head with huge amounts of police and military protection. So in some ways, you know, we feel this is an open battle here. It's a contest. for what direction will the United States go in. I'm wondering, in the case of Germany, because Germany, while there is this rising tide of right-wing, dynamic right-wing growth, there's a lot of people who don't go for this, who don't believe in this, who promote anti-racism and have a welcoming attitude towards asylum seekers. Will there be that kind of polarization?
Well, it's a struggle for the hearts and minds of the working class between the far right and the ideologically driven left. And given the huge success that you had with your counter-demonstration to the Nazis and the KKK in Washington recently, it shows that that battle can be won. However, in Europe, you're right, there is a lot of polarization, because when the asylum seekers came in 2015, there was huge sympathy for them in Germany. There was massive demonstrations welcoming them when they came into the train stations. It was overwhelming. You would watch it with tears in your eyes. So it's not true to say that the far right are making all headway. But combine this with the economic fortunes of the German working class, which has seen their wages go down. The German working class traditionally enjoyed a high standard of living compared to the working class throughout the West because of its economic model. But the Germans, Angela Merkel, are bringing in more liberal reforms. They're pushing down wages. There have been pension reforms and so forth. And this is manna from heaven for the far right. Now, anti-Nazis did come out in Germany to their great credit, but I believe they were heavily outnumbered in that instance. The problem we have, Brian, is I think sections of the left have been disorientated by, for example, the election of Trump in 2016 and Brexit in the UK, because there's an anti-establishment kernel within these populist far-right groupings and organizations. For example, Trump was making more noises about resetting relations with Russia and pulling back from foreign wars on the part of the US ruling class and the US military. Brexit was all about repatriating powers to the UK, had some sort of anti-austerity rhetoric in there. And I think sections of the left bought into that. And that's very dangerous. And I think the left, in parts of the West, have not been prepared for the rise of the far right. You guys certainly have in the US. You saw that after Charlottesville. I think that was a wake-up call for the left in the US. And obviously you understand what Trump is and what he really does represent. But in Germany in particular, the rise of this AfD grouping, obviously we also have Pegida, which predates the AfD. But the AfD is a reconstituted far right that is enjoying significant electoral success. And that's very worrying. And this is kind of what we're seeing with Brexit on the back of Brexit. When your former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson and also putative Prime Minister coming out openly in a newspaper article in The Telegraph attacking Muslim women for wearing the niqab, you understand what's happening. Steve Bannon's been spending a lot of time in Europe talking about he wants to destroy the EU. That is not from a left-wing perspective. We're against neoliberalism as much as anyone, but we understand there's a difference between the near enemy, which is the far right, and the far enemy, which is the neoliberals and the liberal centrists. But as I say, a section of the left has become disorientated by what's been going on because of the anti-establishment character of the far right, which is just really a garb which is used to try and sow false consciousness among a working class that's been left battered and bruised by years of neoliberalism and compounded by austerity in recent years.
We're talking with John White. He's the host of the weekly Sputnik radio show, Hard Facts. John, we have just a little bit over a minute left. I want to pick up on something else that you mentioned earlier on, which is that the quote-unquote mainstream establishment politicians are enabling the rise of the far right in Germany and as a general rule when these types of phenomena raise their heads. How is that happening in Germany? I mean, Angela Merkel's coalition almost fell apart as a consequence of this very dynamic.
Because Angela Merkel started to succumb to the far-right rhetoric about asylum seekers are a problem, they're involved in mass rapes. You saw the thing in Cologne a few years ago on New Year's where it was alleged that groups of asylum seekers were raping or sexually abusing or sexually assaulting white German girls. It turned out that it was not the case, that these were natural-born Germans who were involved in that, and it was magnified and there was splicing video footage from other issues and so on, other incidences of this kind. And so Angela Merkel rolled back and now they've come down harder on asylum seekers. So she's accepted that there is a problem with asylum seekers. But what's not been factored into this, Walter, is the role of Western foreign policy in creating these refugee crises. And because this is where it goes back to the establishment, they don't want to admit their own culpability in this crisis, so it's easy for them to deflect and to give ground to the far right on these issues. And so we see now, even in Germany, that the far right is making inroads into the army and into the police. We see that the off-duty policemen have been identified as being part of these far right groups.
Yeah, that's a really crucial part too. I mean, it's in the actual institutions of the government. Unfortunately, we're all out of time. We've been joined from Edinburgh, Scotland, by John White. He's the host of the weekly Sputnik radio show, Hard Facts. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
The Russian defense minister today announced that huge military drills involving hundreds of thousands of soldiers will take place in the country's east next month, with a sizable contingent of Chinese troops expected to participate. Many are taking this as a sign that the two rising powers are moving closer together in response to the U.S. government's new doctrine of, quote, major power competition, close quote. We're joined from Moscow by international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda. Mark, welcome back.
Hi, Brian, Walter. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Likewise. Thank you so much for joining. Help our audience over here understand what's going on. Of course, this is being treated in the U.S. media as another act of aggression. Kind of interesting, but nonetheless, a big deal in terms of what the Russian government's pose is. How do you make this out?
Yeah, so this is suggested that it will be the largest Russian military game since the Soviet Union in 1981, the Zapad exercises. And from what we've heard in recent hours, it may actually be bigger than that in many respects. Now, this is just the latest in a series of largest military exercises ever back and forth between NATO and Russia. Russia has had Andacondo 2017, Andacondo 2018. In October, we're looking forward to a NATO Trident Juncture, which will see the largest ever military war games held by NATO in Norway, with some 40,000 troops on Russia's border. So this is just the latest in a series of war game escalations that are clearly indicating that both blocks, and I think it's fair to talk about them this way now, are preparing for great power conflict. And certainly this has been building, but it has been increased, and it is discussed about in the U.S. national security strategy this year, which for the first time marked a major shift from a focus on terrorism operations in the Mideast to great power conflict as the primary security threat to the United States. And from these type of exercises, it is obvious that Russia and China feel the same way. And this is the first time that Russia and China have had a long series of joint military exercises, bilateral, often under the aegis of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, both on land and at sea for several years now. And they keep getting bigger, more integrated, show more interoperability. But this is the first time that Chinese troops will participate in one of Russia's big annual four military exercises. Vostok is the east, and there are four big annual military exercises in Russia a year. Zapad in the west, the central district, the Caucasus, which is Russia's south, and the east, Vostok. And this is the eastern exercises. And the words are today that it will involve some 300,000 Russian troops. This is usually inflated a little. It will probably include the numbers of those who are simply on alert rather than those actively military participating. But we can expect in excess of 150,000 to be actively participating. Over 1,000 aircraft, two of Russia's fleets, the Northern and Pacific Fleet, its aerospace forces, special forces, all of Russia's military fields across the board will be participating, along with the Chinese, some 3,200 People's Liberation Army troops, some 30 fixed-wing aircraft, some 900 vehicles from them as well. And Mongolia will be participating, which is another interesting indication of a greater cohesion of the Eurasian area militarily and politically.
Mark Sloboda is our guest. He joins us from Moscow. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, I want to just kind of remind our audience and have you comment on it. You know, at the time of the Chinese Revolution, when the People's Republic of China was formed, Mao Zedong came to Moscow. He spent a couple months there. He met with Stalin and other leaders, from which a friendship and military mutual defense treaty was signed. Shortly thereafter, there was the Korean War. That was in June 1950 till 1953. The Chinese directly engaged in Korea with perhaps more than a million military personnel. The Soviets provided military aid. The hallmark of China-Soviet alliance really set the stage for a lot of what happened in the 1950s. But then that alliance not only frayed, first as an ideological dispute, then a party-to-party dispute, but ultimately a state-to-state dispute. And then the United States intervened to basically win China into what was in essence an anti-Soviet alliance starting in the 1970s. And that pretty much tipped the relationship of forces, the balance of forces in the world, I would say, to the advantage of the United States. It's interesting now, Russia is not led by a communist party. China, of course, still is led by a communist party, but with, historically not as much of an influence of ideology as it was, say, in the 1950s. But here you see the two countries coming together, not on an ideological basis, but on the basis of national interests. How permanent might this be? Is it permanent? I mean, it certainly was hoped to be permanent in the 50s, but it was broken apart.
Yeah, permanent is a long word, and I don't think it's really useful, but it is increasing, and it shows no signs of any deterioration. It shows the exact opposite. It shows ever increasing across military, political, economic, cultural, scientific, all spheres. Now, it's come a long way because, as you said, actually in the late 1960s, it broke out into open conflict that is little discussed historically between the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China in the Amur Basin. And there was a significant loss of life, particularly on the Chinese side during this. So they actually came to very quiet military blows that had the potential, but was at least tamped down. And then the U.S., Nixon and Kissinger flipping China in the early 1970s, I think was the decisive political maneuver, geopolitical maneuver in the Cold War. Once that happened, the Cold War was won. If it hadn't happened, things could have been quite different. But once this split occurred between a communist Russia, Soviet Union, and a communist China, that was it. The Cold War was, for all intents and purposes, its fate was written. But beginning in the late 1990s with Yeltsin and then continued to a much greater degree by Putin, there has been an incredible rapprochement between Russia and China. They've settled all their boundary disputes with some very slight compromises, particularly on the Russian side, giving up a few half islands in the middle of rivers bordering the two that no one really cared about. But it was seen as a positive gesture. The borders are completely demilitarized. We're seeing all these military and political cooperation. Just over the last year, they've actually begun joint missile defense exercises as well, which indicates that Russia and China don't see each other anymore largely as a strategic nuclear threat, because you don't have joint missile defense exercises with someone you see as a foe. And this indicates also that they foresee that any strategic nuclear conflict that embroils one would naturally involve both. And this is the beginning of what we can begin to talk about. They always prefer to use the term strategic partnership. There's been, from both countries since the end of the Cold War, there's been a big reluctance to form bloc geopolitics to form, you know, what might be said as alliances. There's been both sides will very quietly hush up such discussion. But I just want to draw your attention to the Chinese PLA China military official online discussion of the Vostok 2018 exercises, and here in official Chinese military government words, objectively, the purpose of the large military drills by China and Russia is self-evident. Some hegemonic powers target China and Russia as their biggest threats, meaning, of course, the United States, giving heavy blows to the two countries in political, economic, and military areas. Such actions have severely threatened regional and even global peace and stability. Therefore, the China-Russia alliance is a reasonable stance against the hegemonic impulse and for safeguarding peace and stability of the region and the world. And this is the official PA China military website talking openly of an alliance between China and Russia. And that's a big political step forward. And it's a clear indication to the U.S. that it's a response to their national security strategy, as well as a response to U.S. and NATO posturing in the South China Sea, in the Taiwanese Straits, as well as these ever-increasingly large NATO military exercises and the permanent stationing of troops that we are seeing on Russia's western border. So things are escalating. It has been suggested that Trump, in his attempt to improve relations with Russia, has actually been influenced by Henry Kissinger, who has strongly been pushing the U.S. to shift towards Russia in a balancing act to try to bring Russia into its orbit against China, which it sees as a larger long-term strategic threat. In fact, back in the 1970s, Kissinger told Nixon that if your successor is smart, in some 20 years, he'll be shifting the other way.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That was the voice of Mark Sloboda. We were talking to him from Moscow. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Iran's parliament censured President Hassan Rouhani today and referred him to the judiciary. This move comes just 2 days after the ministers of labor and finance were fired by lawmakers. What does this have to do with the U.S. sanctions on the country? What does it mean about the Iranian government? We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He is an expert on American studies and postcolonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Welcome back, Mohammed.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So these are pretty dramatic developments. Tell us about the significance of these, the impeachments of the ministers, and now, perhaps even more dramatically, the censuring and referral of President Hassan Rouhani.
Well, the impeachment of the ministers is important, and it's largely because parliamentarians don't believe that the sanctions were the only reason why the government had so many problems over the past few months. And it wasn't the only reason why the currency fell so rapidly. With regards to today and President Rouhani's presence in parliament, actually, that's not really all that important, except for the fact that it's very newsworthy, because this is the first time that a president has actually been summoned to parliament to explain himself. But the referral to the judiciary is symbolic. It's basically a slap on the wrist. They gave him 5 questions to answer. They were satisfied with one of the responses, and they were unsatisfied with the 4 others. So it wasn't a pretty day for the president, but this referral to the judiciary isn't really It doesn't really mean that he's going to go to court or anything like that.
Mohamed Mirandi is our guest.
Yeah, and it really says something, Mohamed, about the character of the Iranian government. I mean, in the United States, it's presented as, you know, this absolute dictatorship where the supreme leader has total authority over the country. But, I mean, there's actually pretty lively debate, perhaps more lively than in the U.S. political system.
Take the word perhaps out of your sentence.
Yeah, right. I mean, certainly... I mean, if we just think about like what issues are in bounds, I mean, the debates going on now at its core are about like fundamental things about the country's role in the world and foreign policy, and it can be vigorously and openly debated, right?
It is, yes. I think any if the unfortunate thing is that people in the United States, of course, don't speak Persian. If some of the things that are written in Iranian newspapers or websites or on debated in parliament, if they were translated into English, I think your viewers would understand why what you said is true, and that in Iran, politics are much more, let's say, colorful and hard hitting than in the United States. And you know, one example is McCain. When you know, after he died, you see that despite the fact that he, you know, the role that he played in bombing Vietnam, the role he played in destroying Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen, Syria, his support for apartheid in Palestine, you see that even Bernie Sanders and almost everyone in the political mainstream has nothing but very, very extraordinarily high praise for him. Something that you wouldn't see in Iran.
It's actually a more diverse, less monolithic political discourse within the ruling establishment in Iran, and probably almost most countries of the world, than it is in the United States. I mean, even here we have Ocasio-Cortez, the woman, young 28-year-old, who was running for as a Democrat, but she's a member of Democratic Socialists of America. She had to get on board.
In New Jersey.
In the Bronx.
Oh, in the Bronx.
Yeah, in New York. Immediately after McCain died, she got right on it. She said he was an unparalleled
example of like decency or
unparalleled level of decency. It wasn't even demanded of her. I mean, as a, you know, left socialist liberal kind of person, who a lot of people were very inspired that she won the election against this old time machine politician in the Bronx. And yet even she, like Sanders and these others, The Nation magazine, I mean, everybody's genuflecting before John McCain. And again, John McCain supported the war in Iraq vigorously. 1 million Iraqis may have died, according to the Lancet Medical Journal. He was vociferous in his support for the bombing of Yugoslavia. I was in Iraq, Mohammed, in 1998 when Operation Desert Fox began. That was the bombing, 4-day bombing by the Clinton campaign. You know, 1,000 bombs.
And McCain was upset about it.
Yeah, McCain was upset. He criticized it for being a pinprick operation. I mean, America dropped 1,000 bombs and missiles on people in Iraq.
And you have to keep in mind also, what you know, the 1 million people that you pointed out died, that's after the invasion. The 1 million other people who died during the sanctions.
Yes, indeed, indeed. 8,000 a month, according to the United Nations, 5,000 of whom were children under the age of 5. And McCain was all about that.
It was all worth it, too, according to the former Secretary of State.
Yeah. Madeleine Albright.
But, you know, that makes it that sort of closes the circle in a way. Madeleine Albright, who is a supporter of Hillary Clinton, she said hell had a special place for women who didn't support Hillary in 2016. While asked by Leslie Stahl on national TV whether the killing of 500,000 Iraqi babies was worth it, she said, oh, that's a tough question, but yes, the price is worth it. Killing 500,000 Iraqi babies? And yet that kind of shows why the Democrats can fall in line behind John McCain, because in fact, they're the same in many ways.
That's right. That's right. I think Chomsky once said it's sort of like it's a one-party system with two factions, something like that.
Yeah.
It's one party with two right wings, I think was the saying.
Yeah, two right-wing factions. But the thing is that if you speak to most people in the United States and almost anyone in the political establishment, their understanding of Iran is that this is, I don't know, some Saudi Arabia is how they depict Iran as being. In other words, the image that they have of Iran and Iranians and the political order in Iran is what actually exists in Saudi Arabia. But you know, it's the narrative is so long lasting, and so it has such a strength to it that if you tell anyone anything otherwise, they'll just say, "Oh, you're an apologist, or you're mad, or you don't know what you're talking about." But the reality is that, you know, they have to admit it every now and then. The president was, you know, called on to go to parliament, and he was given an earful by the different MPs, and he was censured.
Again, here you have all of this use of prosecutorial politics in Washington. You know, like prosecutions and legal issues are being used to replace political opposition or as a tool of political opposition. But again, George W. Bush, in spite of the fact that a million Iraqis died, or Dick Cheney, or Donald Rumsfeld, or Condoleezza Rice, or all of them who committed this war of aggression, they've never been censored. I mean, again, Mohammed Mirandi is our guest. The picture of Iran as a monolith is just basically bogus. It's a lie. And it's just designed to create animus and hostility against people in Iran or against the Iranian government so that America can maybe go drop missiles on Iran. I mean, not that it will, but I mean, it has that impact.
It justifies anything that they do. When you dehumanize, when you delegitimize, it basically allows you to do anything that you want. So, for example, in order to justify what Israel does in Gaza, they dehumanize the Palestinians. They say that Palestinian women throw their children in front of bullets. And so the Palestinians are seen as inhuman, as mothers who don't care for their children. And therefore, what the Israelis do is justified. In the case of Iran, when it's a dictatorship, there's no democracy. People can't speak. Therefore, if the United States bombs the country, as you say, or if it sanctions the country, they say, well, they deserve it.
We are joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and postcolonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.